Welcome to History Lost in Time, from one enthusiast to others. And welcome to the third episode regarding the history of radio broadcasting in Germany. In this episode, I will talk about radio broadcasting in the Third Reich with the focus on foreign countries. With that, I mean the interactions between German radio broadcasting and neighboring countries, as well as radio stations run by Germans in other countries. The German-speaking foreign radio broadcasters will be discussed in another episode and only mentioned briefly.
Why this topic today?
In the last episode, I had a national focus on pre-war radio broadcasting, so now it's only logical to have an international focus. Radio broadcasting has never been a completely national matter. That is actually true for all media, but particularly for electronic media.
Political background and commentary.
No political agenda here. I simply want to discuss something that interests me personally.
The sources.
My sources consist of one book and two CD box sets. Radio unterm Hakenkreuz von 1933 bis 1945, die Geschichte des Rundfunks in Deutschland. Translation: Radio under the Swastika from 1933 to 1945, the history of radio broadcasting in Germany. Published by Hans Sarkovic, Production Hessischer Rundfunk 2004. This CD package of the Hessia Broadcasting Corporation provides a very interesting and broad overview to the listener, and also includes a lot of snippets of broadcasts from the era. Rundfunk in Deutschland, herausgegeben von Hans Bausch, Band 2, Ansgar Diller, Rundfunkpolitik im Dritten Reich. Translation: Radio Broadcasting in Germany, published by Hans Bausch, Volume 2 by Ansgar Diller, Radio Broadcasting Politics in the Third Reich, published by Deutscher Taschenbuchverlag München, 1980. This book is basically a standard work regarding radio broadcasting history in Germany. It informs the reader comprehensively about radio broadcasting politics, and it provides the reader with a good and thorough overview. Geheime Sender, translation Secret Radio Stations, published by Hans Sarkovic, Production Hessischer Rundfunk and Deutsches Rundfunkarchiv, 2016. This second box is even more thorough than the first one by the same publisher, but its focus is internationally. Let's start with some explanation and delimitation. In this episode, I will talk about German radio broadcasting and its effects on foreign countries and radio stations run by Germans in other countries. With the latter, I mean stations run by emigrants. Foreign broadcasters with programs in German, like stations run by France or the Soviet Union, I will only mention briefly when I will discuss interactions between broadcasting campaigns. I have a ton of material regarding foreign broadcasters, and it's simply too much to use in this episode. Instead, I will make another episode focusing on that topic. Also, I will not sum up the last episode, which discussed German radio broadcasting within Germany. For that, please listen to episode 10. The German shortwave radio station aimed at Germans abroad had already existed in the Weimar Republic. During the times of the Republic, the main goal was to establish a link between Germany and the Germans abroad and to provide them with German radio programming. In the Third Reich, the shortwave radio station was used to produce and distribute propaganda. But again, the focus was Germans abroad. The people of other countries were not the target. That's why the broadcasts remained completely German. Specialized directional antennas distributed the transmissions worldwide. Starting in April 1933, the antenna for North America was operational. Five others were set up until May 1935. The shortwave radio station did not send a standard program, but adapted its program to the target regions. In order to manage the workload, the station needed a lot more manpower. In 1933, only 7 people worked for foreign broadcasting at the shortwave radio station. By 1938, this had increased to 242. A special highlight of the shortwave radio service was the Olympic Games of 1936. In order to allow the world to participate live on the radio, 3 transmitters with 12 kilowatts of power and 8 transmitters with 50 kilowatts of power were set up. The Winter Games were covered with 287 programs in 14 languages. The Summer Games were covered with 2,500 programs in 28 languages. Distribution was worldwide. These programs were also supposed to give the impression of Germany as a cosmopolitan country, but also as a tightly organized autocracy. As already said in the last episode, the Volksempfänger radio devices VE301 and DKE38 did not have a short-wave receiver module. That means most German listeners were limited to long-wave and medium-wave broadcasts. This was sufficient to receive the German radio stations. At night, reception of European neighbors was also possible, but worldwide reception is only possible with shortwave. High-end devices like Telefunken Meister Super provided this ability, but they were a lot more expensive than the Volksempfänger devices. The ability to receive foreign stations was very unpopular with the Nazi leadership, as that reduced the effectiveness of Nazi propaganda. However, it was not illegal to receive foreign radio stations. Frowned upon, yes, but not illegal. However, plans to shield the population from foreign radio stations in case of war were already drawn up in 1935-36. Foreign broadcasters were usually restrained when it came to critical comments about internal German affairs, since there was no desire to create conflict with Germany. This only changed during times of crisis. However, German emigrants running their own radio stations were not restrained at all. I would like to briefly introduce two of these emigrant radio stations. The first one had the very innocent name Landscape Radio Station Berlin. It ran only for a short time, December 1934 and January 1935. Despite its name, it was not operated in Berlin, but in Prague. It was managed by Otto Strasser, brother of Nazi politician Gregor Strasser. Gregor had been sidelined by Hitler even before the Nazis took power. During the Röhm coup, he was murdered. Even before that, Otto had left the Nazi party because of severe differences with Hitler. He set up kind of a left-wing National Socialism or National Bolshevism. His Black Front organization was a non-democratic National Socialist opposition to Hitler. Strasser's Landscape Radio Station Berlin was supposed to give the impression that the station was operated from within Germany. Strasser used his inside knowledge from his time within the Nazi Party to broadcast private, secret, and embarrassing details about the Nazi leadership. German departments that permanently listened to all foreign radio stations quickly determined the true location of the radio station. When diplomatic efforts with the Czechoslovakian government failed, the secret service of the SS, the SD, was tasked with eliminating the radio station. Alfred Naujox, who later was in charge of the Gleiwitz action prior to World War II, was ordered to handle this. He failed to get Otto Strasser, however he murdered his radio technician, thereby forcing Strasser to abandon his radio station. Strasser managed to escape and to survive the war. Since his radio station only ran for a relatively short time and on shortwave only, its effect was probably very limited. However, the effect of the other radio station, the German Liberty Station 29.8, was a lot stronger. The name was based on its frequency, 10,067 kHz or 29.8 meters wavelength. This station was run by communist emigrants. It also gave the impression of being operated from within Germany, and that's where the Gestapo was searching for it. However, it was actually operated from Madrid, which at the time was still held by the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War. Due to strict security measures, the German security services never managed to find the true location of the station. The Liberty Station was in operation from spring 1937 to March 1939, so for about 2 years. The Communist Party of Germany organized most of it. Walter Ulbricht, who later became head of state of post-war communist East Germany, participated within the political leadership of the station. However, contributions were not only made by communists, but also by writers like the brothers Heinrich and Thomas Mann, Anna Segers and Bertolt Brecht, scientists like Albert Einstein, and non-Germans like Ernest Hemingway. Some of the people working for the station later worked in the state-owned broadcasting services of post-war communist East Germany. The radio station ran every evening for 1 to 1.5 hours. The content was mostly general news, special news from Germany, and special news from the Spanish Civil War. It was a mix of the truth and communist propaganda. Due to the existing communist underground network in Germany, the radio station was able to obtain up-to-date news from Germany. This fact alone strengthened the Gestapo's opinion that the radio station had to be operated from within Germany. The Nazi leadership attacked the radio station with jamming devices, however the station continued to evade the jamming by changing its frequency slightly. Listening to the radio station was not illegal, and thanks to the communist underground network, it was widely listened to within leftist circles in Germany. The radio station finally had to shut down when Franco's nationalist forces captured Madrid. Next, I'd like to talk about broadcasting interactions between Germany and some of its neighbors, and I'd like to start with Austria. Right after the Nazis took power in Germany, there were conflicts with Austria. One might even call it a radio broadcasting war. After all, the goal of the German government was a Nazi takeover in Austria. During these internal struggles in Austria, the Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss was murdered. However, in the end, the Nazi grab for power failed, and with it, the German radio broadcasting campaign that was supposed to support this grab for power. However, anti-Austrian propaganda from Germany and anti-German propaganda from Austria remained the norm. In 1936, relations between both countries normalized after a treaty was signed. Both states agreed to stop the hostile propaganda against each other and to not interfere in internal affairs. As a consequence, German radio no longer talked badly about Austria, but rather focused on praising Germany. That had some pull effect on the Austrian population. When Austria was annexed by Germany in 1938, the Austrian radio services were quickly taken over and aligned with the German radio services. The station in Vienna became the Reichssender Wien, the supporting stations in Innsbruck, Salzburg and Bregenz became the property of the Reichssender München and Stuttgart. The second area that became sort of a battleground for radio services was the Saar region, a small area in western Germany bordering both France and Luxembourg. Until 1935, this area was sort of in between France and Germany following World War I. The Weimar Republic had already started to influence the population there with pro-German radio broadcasting. However, the German radio stations were very difficult to receive there. On the other hand, the French radio station in Strasbourg, that was regularly broadcasting German language content, pro-French content obviously, was easy to receive in the Saar region. The situation only changed in March 1934, when finally the population of the Saar region was also able to receive German radio stations in good quality. The radio wave propaganda duel caused diplomatic issues between Germany and France, however neither side wanted to back down. During a referendum in 1935, the vast majority of the population voted to join Germany. Following that, the situation calmed down a bit. Something similar happened in the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. In 1925, the Czechoslovakian radio services had started to regularly broadcast German language content in order to make the German population feel like they belonged to the new state. However, the situation between Germans and Czechs was very difficult and full of conflict. The situation with Otto Strasser's radio station in 1934-35 worsened the tensions between Germany and Czechoslovakia even more. The German radio stations close to the border increased their pro-German propaganda in the Sudetenland over time. Czechoslovakia reacted very late. New programs and new radio stations targeting the Sudetenland and German regions close to Czechoslovakia were only set up in May 1938. In September 1938, the German radio services reacted by producing and broadcasting Czech language content. The language used within the radio stations became more and more aggressive. Simultaneously, the diplomatic situation worsened. The German radio stations reported about true and invented anti-German activities of Czechs within the Sudetenland. Shortly before the end of the crisis, which ended with the annexation of the Sudetenland by Germany and the dissolution of Czechoslovakia, The German radio services started producing English and French language content and broadcast it towards Western Europe. In the Radio Broadcast Politics book, a document is quoted on page 252, which lists the goals of the Czech language programs of the German radio services. The following goals were supposed to be achieved. A. To undermine the Czech people's trust in the government. B. To undermine the Czechs' trust in their supposedly allied foreign countries. C. To clearly expose Bolshevism and its backers not only as enemies of the people, but also as the originators of the danger of war in Europe. On top of that, the programs gave a generally positive impression of Germany and called upon the peoples of Czechoslovakia to aim for national independence, thereby dissolving Czechoslovakia from within. Something similar happened during the conflict regarding the Memel region. This small strip of land at the outer edge of East Prussia had been disconnected from Germany as a result of the Versailles Treaty. In 1923, it was annexed by Lithuania. The German population opposed this annexation from the start. Starting in 1934, Germany started broadcasting specialized programs for the Memel region into the area. Lithuania reacted by setting up jamming devices, which in turn led Germany to set up jammers targeting the Lithuanian radio broadcast within the Memel region. When Germany and Lithuania signed an economic treaty in 1936, the situation calmed down. However, the political situation remained the same. During the entire occupation, the unified German list won either 24 or 25 of the 29 seats within the regional parliament. A Lithuanization was impossible. In March 1939, Germany annexed the territory. The Lithuanian radio station was taken over by the Reichssender Königsberg. Danzig was in a similar between-the-front-line situation comparable to the Saar region and the Memel region. Since 1920, the city was autonomous and de jure under the protection of the League of Nations. However, when it came to the economy and tariffs, the city was basically a part of Poland. In 1926, a private agreement was reached regarding setting up and operating a radio station in Danzig. The Reichspost kept deliberately out of it so that the deal remained free of politics. In May 33, the Nazi Party won the local elections in Danzig. Out of 72 seats in the local parliament, it got 38. Politically, Danzig attached itself to Germany from that point on. An enabling act was passed in 1933 already. All opposition parties were banned until 1937. Anti-Jewish laws were also passed. The League of Nations, de jure in charge of Danzig politically, was unable to stop this. When war broke out in September 1939, the Danzig radio station was the first one to report about it. Relations between Poland and Germany during the time of the Third Reich were rather unsteady. During the time of the Weimar Republic, there were numerous warlike and civil warlike conflicts along the new borders and within areas where Poles and Germans lived side by side. Relations were catastrophically bad. After the Nazis took over, the situation actually improved and resulted in the Friendship Pact of 1934. The radio broadcasting conflict between both countries ended. There wasn't only a radio broadcasting ceasefire, there was actually some level of cooperation going on. In a limited fashion, programs and concert broadcasts were exchanged between German and Polish radio services. When Polish-German relations worsened in 1938-39, the same happened on the level of radio broadcasting. When Hitler cancelled the Friendship Pact in April 1939, German radio stations started broadcasting pro-German and anti-Polish propaganda. Programs were also broadcast in Polish and Ukrainian, the latter ones aimed at the Ukrainian minority in eastern Poland. The Polish radio services were very restrained in order not to increase tensions. In the final days before the outbreak of the war, German radio stations reported about true and invented anti-German actions in Poland and border violations of Polish soldiers. The campaign culminated with the attack of the SD on the Gliwice radio station. This incident was used as the reason to invade Poland within the German propaganda. During this attack, the SD attacked the radio station and broadcast Polish propaganda. Due to the limited infrastructure on site, the station was not really designed to create its own content, the effect was limited and the entire operation almost failed. A corpse that was organized beforehand was left at the station as proof that this was a Polish attack. A radio battlefield of another kind was Luxembourg. The radio station was particularly annoying to Germany, but also to other European countries. The station in Luxembourg was set up in 1929 using French money, and it did not follow the international wavelength plan. So basically, it was a state-run pirate radio station. Germany wasn't the only country complaining about this. Britain and Denmark were also not fond of it. The Luxembourg radio station mostly broadcast pro-French programs. Diplomatic pressure had no effect. However, when war broke out, the Luxembourg radio station switched to neutral programming. Relations between France and Germany after World War I were always tense, to say the least. The German radio station in Stuttgart started broadcasting German language programs for Germans in Alsace-Lorraine starting in 1926. France retaliated in 1930 by broadcasting German language programs for the Saar area in southwestern Germany from the Strasbourg radio station. I already mentioned how the Saar region story turned out. After that, the situation calmed down a bit, but this only meant that the status before the Saar region referendum was restored. France still broadcast pro-French programs to southwestern Germany, and Germany still broadcast pro-German programs to Alsace-Lorraine. When the Rhineland was militarized in 1936, both sides reacted with special programs. In the Radio Politics book, there is an evaluation of the French Foreign Language Broadcasting Service by the Reich Ministry of War, quoted on page 267. The experiences of the tense period in March of this year, 1936, can be summarized as follows. French radio is an excellent technical weapon of intellectual warfare, which is tactically used and conducted so skillfully that in every future case of foreign policy tension, it will play a very important role in influencing world public opinion. So the French Foreign Language Broadcasting Service was taken very seriously. The French increased the amount of programming they broadcast, which created more diplomatic tensions. However, as before, neither side wanted to back down. As mentioned earlier, during the Sudetenland crisis, there were some sporadic French language programs broadcast by Germany. Starting in August 1939, this became a regular thing. Finally, I would like to talk about the radio broadcasting opponent in the East, the Soviet Union. Neither the British BBC nor the American radio stations were really active before the outbreak of the war. However, the Soviet Union had operated a shortwave radio station for a long time, and German language content was broadcast since 1929. Its goal was pro-communist agitation. Since 1929, the Reichswehr was monitoring these broadcasts. The content consisted of the hymn of the Socialist International, a communist organization, communist music and poetry, lectures, and later also reports and interviews with Germans, as well as answering listener questions. All parties in Germany, from the far right through the center up to and including the Social Democrats, opposed these broadcasts. In 1931, the government under Heinrich Brüning made them a top priority and addressed them through diplomatic channels with the Soviet Union. Once those initiatives failed, the German government installed jamming devices and informed the German population about the propaganda nature of these broadcasts. When the Nazis took power, monitoring and jamming was increased. When the Spanish Civil War started and Germany and the Soviet Union found themselves on opposing sides, the Soviets increased their propaganda activities. The Nazi government was well aware that Radio Moscow had its fair share of listeners in Germany. After all those millions of communist voters hadn't vanished after the Nazi takeover in 1933. However, in 1937, Hitler opposed a law that would have banned listening to Radio Moscow because he thought that it was impossible to enforce. So the Nazi regime created a sort of ban. Listening to Radio Moscow was legal unless any kind of communist activity was associated with it. So it was possible and allowed to listen to Soviet radio, but it was risky. Germany didn't counter the Soviet propaganda with broadcasts. The radio services did anti-Soviet programming only internally. There was no foreign radio station targeting Russians, Ukrainians, or other Soviet people. When the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed in August 1939, anti-German propaganda from the Soviets ended immediately. However, as is well known, that was just a short break that ended in June 1941. More about that in a future episode.
Finishing words.
Radio broadcasting, as well as basically all electronic media, knows no borders, and that creates interaction between one's own country and foreign countries. Today, this is even more so the case than in the past. Audio and video content of all kinds, even if they are originally targeting a domestic audience, is now broadcast globally via the internet. Back then, the same was true with shortwave radio content. Less people received it, but the same principles were true, and one can observe similar effects. The study of radio broadcasting history allows one to gain some insight into today's media landscape and the effect the media has. The fact that back then there were fewer actors makes it easier to see and understand these effects. When it comes to political content, foreign language content of other nations, and state-run media, one has to think critically about the content. Is that stuff really meant to inform, or to influence, or both? That was important back then, and it is still important today. In the next radio broadcasting episode, I will talk about German radio broadcasting within Germany during the war.
Thank you for your interest.